Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Echoes. I'm Paula Schiller, and this is the second part of a conversation with Professor Tom Johnston about Athabaskan music. Today we'll discuss the Nulato stick dance before moving on to some songs from the Cook Inlet region. I don't suppose it's entirely correct to name the stick dance after Nulato. This year and in alternate years, it's held in Keltag. What shall we call it?
Well, the Athabaskan people down at Nulato have their own name for it. It's called the Hio dance, or Hio, H-I-apostrophe-O. And they sing a special group of songs called Hio Keleka. There's 14 of these special songs which are reserved for this ceremony. It occurs about every other year in March or April, downriver at Keltag or Nulato. I think they try and arrange to alternate it. And it used to be called the Feast for the Dead. And it's in memory of people that have passed away in the past couple of years. And the widows or the bereaved mothers, they and their families hold this week-long potlatch. And although there's only about 300 people living in Nulato and Keltag, in each village, usually about 1,500 people show up.
Are they mostly relatives, or is it some people just curious, or who comes?
Well, friends and relatives come. See, one of the purposes, I think, of the Hio stick dance is to renew the social ties with surrounding villages, to keep up trading partners and joking cousins and other friends, you know, in the other villages. Actually, this ceremony has got four main purposes. The first reason is that it lays to rest the wandering spirit of the deceased person. And secondly, it repays the obligation to those people who assisted at the burial, the people who dressed the bodies and carried the casket. And three, it reduces the loss by it sort of mystically replaces the dead people, because during this ceremony the pallbearers symbolize and become the dead people. They are fed the special delicacies of food that the deceased people liked, and they are given a new set of winter clothing. They are dressed by the people that wish to honor them. Then the last reason is that it's a kind of emotional release, a cathartic release for people that have been cooped up all winter, and it's just past the darkest and coldest part of the winter, and here's spring coming, and so everybody has a good time.
Sounds like it's partly like a good old-fashioned Irish wake in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear an example from the Nulato stick dance.
Hey!
1975, I was very privileged to be permitted to attend the Athabaskan stick dance. And
is that one of the recordings you made then?
Yes, I taped that. And it's called stick dance because a large spruce pole is erected in the center of the community hall. And this is decorated with ribbons and with furs, and the people dance around it. And they also dance the gifts around it. The gifts, which is food and clothing and blankets, are wrapped up in large rolls of calico cloth, and people hold the large long roll, like a roll of carpet, under their arms and dance around the pole. Then afterwards, the furs are cut down and cut into strips for use as ruffs and given out as gifts. And this is a very expensive affair. These people are not rich. They live in an area where the cost of living is high because everything has to be brought in, and the income is low. There's no jobs. And so they make a great sacrifice to accumulate all of this food and clothing, and then it's all given away as gifts to people and friends and people in the village. An interesting aspect of this stick dance is towards the end they have a masked dance where they wear elaborate carved wooden masks and even sing some Eskimo-style songs. I guess this is because they are close to the Eskimo territory.
We have... that was kind of a fast song. And is that one of the more...
The fast dance song. It's quite a well-known one. And it was sung during the warming-up period of the stick dance. Now, this next example is a privately owned song. It's owned by the lady, and it's a family song, and she sings it, and she announces who it's for and why it was composed, and it's sung solo, and it's a little slower.
That was a song from the Koyukon region, and again we're going to move rapidly to the Cook Inlet region.
Yes, the Athabaskan people not only reside in the north, above the Arctic Circle, and in the east near the Canadian border, and in the west down near the Eskimo area on the lower Yukon, but they reside in the Susitna and Tayonek and other villages around Cook Inlet. And these people are called the Tanaina. And here we'll hear Old Chief Shem Pete singing a Tanaina gambling song.
What the hell, yes,
Did you record that one also?
Yes. The linguist, Jim Carey, is a good friend of old Chief Shampete and has been working with him on the language and place names in South Alaska. And Shampete has told his story. He's a very famous old hunter and the brother of several well-known chiefs. And he composed the last Tanaina funeral songs for his two brothers who were chiefs and who died. And Shampete is a very good singer, and we can hear him sing his very personal funeral song here for his brother.
There again, you don't need to be an expert to tell that that was very personal and very...
very sad, yes. When the old people sing these mourning songs, of course, they remember their loved ones. And so it's native music serves a purpose. The mourning songs clear the way through the underbrush for the spirit to pass on the way to the next stage in the spirit world. And the people left behind, they have to sing the songs with reverence and to remember the old people in order to help them as they cross over.
That was Professor Tom Johnston, ethnomusicologist at the University of Alaska. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Echoes. I'm Paula Schiller, and I'd like to introduce you to a new word I learned while talking to Professor Frank Buskey. He's head of the University of Alaska English Department. The word is ethnopoetics, and here's Professor Buskey to define it.
It is a new field of study, I think you would call it, which is defined as poetry of the people, taking the root ethnos, meaning people, and poetry meaning that which they create for themselves to explain themselves to themselves. And there is a marvelous definition of it as being on the interface between poetry and anthropology, but I never know where an interface is, so I'm not comfortable with that definition. So, and what it aims to do is to retrieve oral literature in the way that it makes sense to the people who listen to it as part of their regular cultural heritage, not the translations that we so often get, but how does it sound to them? What does it mean to them? That's the function of ethnopoetics.
Did this come about because some of the native speakers, storytellers, have objected to the way that the stories come out in translation?
I don't know if they have or not, but they certainly should if they haven't. This is a field that did not originate up here. It originated back in the States with people who were studying Indian cultures primarily, and now it has spread to primitive cultures of every kind. I use the word primitive with quotes around it, of course, and not take any kind of attitude toward it except to say it's unlike that which most people are familiar with.
How are, this may not be the fairest question to ask you, how are the people that are studying ethnopoetics that want to make sure that they're being truthful to their material, how are they going to have any idea how the people that originate this material feel?
Well, that's a perfectly fair question, and it's one that the more serious students in the field have addressed. For example, they have gone to live amongst the tribes in the southwestern United States, for example, have been accepted into these tribes, and these people have performed for them, showed them the ways in which telling of the tale are important to the tale, and part of the oral tradition is, of course, that part that is added to a story or invented on the spot. That becomes part of ethnopoetics, too, so that you wind up with a kind of framework on which the storyteller then embroiders in some way. So the people themselves are interested in these things. At the Alaska Native Language Center, for example, our people are very much interested in that. And again, the very fact that presently dictionaries are being produced so that these things can be written down, this is a huge step forward. And I think that although we are still in a halting, stumbling stage with regard to this, one of the things that is being accomplished is that the people who are writing them down are the people who know the stories, who have these stories in their heritage. Heretofore, we have had stories recorded by persons whose cultural backgrounds were different, and they have been sifted through an alien consciousness, and that has added some level of barrier to really knowing what the story is about. So at least we will get closer to the truth of the story, and that, it seems to me, is very important.
It could even be that when you're taping, a non-native goes in to tape a performance or somebody telling a story, that the storyteller changes the story for the non-native, whereas telling the same story to a native audience will get a different, you get a different story.
Yes, yes. There's an interesting example of what happens here, and this is told by Ron Scullin of the Alaska Native Language Center. He had gone into a village and had a man tell a story to him, and when the story was told in the original language, it automatically divided into four distinct units. But when the man translated it into English and told him the same story again, it divided into three separate units, which is, of course, the way we write in English, isn't it? Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But that isn't the way these stories break down when you hear them in their own language.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like an example of that? Okay. This the first thing that I will read is a poem that occurs in a book called I Breathe a New Song, Poems of the Eskimo, edited by Richard Lewis. And it is a very popular, highly acclaimed book. But the way the poem goes in his version is like this. Somebody saw a crow flying by and asked him where he was going. The crow answered, "I am going to wring my grandfather's neck." Well, it just happens that there is another version of this poem that I found, as it had been written down word for word by Diamond Jeunesse, and I think that you will see that we are indeed dealing with the same poem, but this is the way it sounds as told by the man Jeunesse recorded. It's called The Man and the Raven. A man, it is related, asked a raven, "Raven, what are you going off to do?" "Grandfather, his piece of neck, I am going to take back to him." "Where to?" "Patitak on the windward side." "Who, pray, thy grandfather?" "The thinker." "Who, pray, thy mother?" "The dog trace." "Who, pray, thy grandmother?" "Big old ice." "By what, pray thee, do they name thee?" "By the name, poor little thing, they name me." Also, its song exists. The big raven having flesh, the big raven having flesh, hill, one hill, go to the other side of it. Let us return, let us return. Where are those, they headbands? Let me buy them with a flint knife, its case. Yonder my feces, yonder my feces, the low hills in between them. Go and devour, cha, cha, cha. And that's the Eskimo version of the poem. And I think it's a dramatic, interesting dialogue, and but you can see it's the same story.
And you can see what happens when it's changed for or filtered through a different perception. You have other things that we can draw on.
Yes, I've got some riddles from the Koyukon language that were originally written down by Father Julius Jeté, a very marvelous priest who was here in some of the early days, who learned to speak the language fluently, to understand it, and who became aware that amongst these people there was a tradition of riddling at one time of the year. And he wrote them down. They've been recently rediscovered by Richard Dauenhauer, a ethno-poetic specialist who lives in Anchorage, who points out that these are perfect imagist poems. Now, imagism, this was the poetic movement at the beginning of the 20th century that has had a profound influence on modern poetry in both English and in England and the United States. And so, an image being simply a visual picture that is charged with some kind of emotional content and that is very succinctly expressed.
Can you give us an example of some of the more popular
imagist poets? Yes, Ezra Pound wrote the most famous one, and that's the one about the petals on a... Excuse me, here it is. It's called In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. And that's the most single famous imagist poem. And Amy Lowell was an imagist. Marianne Moore, William Carlos Williams, many of the big names in our tradition. And so, but the native people had been doing this very cleverly for a long time without ever knowing what imagism was. And so let me just give you an example. Oh, and there's a tradition with this. The person who makes up the riddle always starts out by saying, riddle me, and then he gives you the definition, and it's frequently a very poetic definition. You're supposed to guess what it is that he's has in his mind. As an example, riddle me, small dots far off on the skyline. And then if you were in tune with this man's mind, you would answer what he had in mind, when the birds return, which is a very lovely picture. Or you can be a very poetic. In these cultures, birds and stars are equated. So there's one, riddle me, the stars are rotting on my sides. And the answer is the high one, Mount McKinley, because it is so high, its top seems to be in the stars, and the people have imagined that the birds fly against the mountain and are killed. And so, therefore, the stars are rotting on my sides.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, let me give you... let's see, here's one. Riddle me, riddle me. We come upstream in red canoes. And that's the salmon returning. But isn't that a nice figure?
Mm-hmm.
And don't they even have that kind of shape? And there's one I wanted to find because it's a... I think this one is a very interesting one, too. Like a broom, I sweep the place... Riddle me, riddle me. Like a broom, I sweep the place around me.
The wind?
The wind is involved. It's withered bunches of grass above the winter snows, blowing the grass around on the snowtop. Oh, here's... I particularly like this one. Riddle me, riddle me. We have our heads in sheepskin hats.
You'll have to tell me.
Okay, this is snow piled up on stumps. So, these are very, very nice things. They sum up very quickly, don't they? A very
mm-hmm.
nice visual image and a sense of the life contained in the image. So I think they're very lovely things.
Professor Frank Buskey, chairman of the University of Alaska English Department and a believer in ethnopoetics. For Chinook Echoes, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.